This Three Beards Media podcast may contain mature themes, and if you're not down with that, we got three words for you. Like the podcast. Nailed it!
Welcome, everybody, to a new episode of False Starts. I am your host, Chris Shipley. As always, we have our co-host and confidant, Bill Blank. Bill, it was a good football weekend for you. Iowa won. Cowboys won. Iowa State lost.
I had like nothing. It's the first weekend in football I can remember in my lifetime, maybe, where I literally had nothing to bitch about. Like there were some calls in the Iowa State game that were bullshit.
Oh
like,
my god! Don't even start with this.
But you can't. Like it wasn't that big a deal. Like it ended up, you know, there was the one was just blatant pass interference, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where Iowa State got the pick. Like yep. you don't even if you say that's not pass interference, you're not even watching.
No, he was all over him. But that I think that was all. But
then the pick six happened right after that.
Right. Yeah.
So like that's whatever.
Ball don't right? lie. Isn't that what it's they say? Ball don't lie.
Yeah, ball don't lie. But also maybe lucky for us the way the offense still really isn't. But you can see that they're still better. Like you can just tell McNamara is that much better.
Yeah, but McNamara can make the throw when he needs to get a first down.
Well, he's just way more
accurate. You don't have a lot of three and outs right now, but you're still struggling to move the ball. So
yeah, but you know, But they only called two penalties the entire game, and that they were both on Iowa State. They called one on Iowa, but it got declined.
So, right.
Two penalties against one team, one penalty against another. You know, it's I can't really. There's nothing really to bitch about, and we won the game. So
well, I mean, I could go into a whole therapy session about my wave of emotions from Saturday, which I was not. I mean, I was resigned. It is what it is. We got a young team. Block punt, you know, you got that pick six. We just, it's a young team. You can't make mistakes like that. So,
yeah.
And when you play a Kirk Ferentz team like that, they're going to capitalize on those mistakes every time. So, for me, it was the Bears game. I was in a complete and utter funk by the middle of the third quarter. And then, of course, I had a glimmer of hope when we scored that touchdown to kind of make it close. And then we just screwed the pooch again. And I'm absolutely so over the whole Chicago Bears organization, and the McCaskies can roll over and die as far as I'm concerned, because they're the worst owners in sports. I channeled my inner Bill Blank. I was ready to murder somebody.
Yeah.
So yeah,
you're going that far, huh?
I was that far with it, because you know what? This is the problem, and then we'll get to our guests because nobody's diamond in to listen to me bitch about the Bears. But here's my problem:
Mental health.
The first game. And I'm already fucking depressed for the entire rest of the year because I already can see the writing on the wall that we're not going to be shit. And now I got to watch this for another 16 games because I'll watch it because I'm some kind of masochist.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Cause what else are you going to do? That's why ownership in Chicago sports in general has always been the way it is. Cause what the fuck else?
Right.
You know, for the longest time, it was like the Cubs didn't care if they won.
People were coming. Yep.
They were fine. Like,
here's the problem. I said this in a tweet. If these politicians want to solve the world problems, they should enact a law that a 13-year-old kid can't pick his favorite football team at 13. Because I made that terrible fucking decision, and now I've been stuck with it for 39 years.
Yeah.
Mature enough to 13 year olds are not mature enough to choose your own favorite team. You should have to because I've been miserable for 39 years.
You're implying it. You sound like a Republican talking about transgender people right now. Listen, 13 year old doesn't know yet.
Yes.
Who they really like.
They should be allowed to control their own body.
We can't allow them to go buy an Urlacher jersey
right.
when they're 13.
Exactly.
That's
one great
hilarious.
85 Bears team has fucked me over for 39 years now.
I actually think that if you change your favorite team after 13, you're a dick.
oh, I can't do it now.
Yeah.
I can't. I mean, I've got shirts. I got jerseys. I mean, I can't.
You've
I can
invested.
Root for another team, but I can't have another favorite team. That's just not a possibility.
Well, that's what's great about having, I don't know, for me, caring more about college than pro, because
yeah,
I can root for the Hawkeyes that are playing and have fun with that in the pro games, you know, like
yep.
Watching the Lions beat the Chiefs and LaPorta and Campbell playing well, you know, that's fun.
Right. Yeah, but that I can. Yeah, I can root. I can now root for some cyclone guys in there. So
when it comes to Iowa, I don't root for fucking anybody. Like I wish there was a way that every other team in college football could be 0-12.
Yeah. Right.
So yeah, we should get to our guests though.
Yeah, because nobody wants to hear me. I mean,
everybody already
went. Follow me on Twitter to hear me bitching about the
with the game. So.
But Bill, I'll let you introduce.
I didn't get a chance to just say anything to you since, you know, because I'm not a real rub it in type of person,
which I appreciate.
I did have somebody say, get mad at me and start talking shit on Facebook, and yeah, went back and forth on that, and
I'll just end it with this. The best prank ever happened was 6 years ago when Iowa State lost, and my neighbor across the street walked over and slipped an Iowa jersey on my dog Bubba outside and then snapped a photo and sent it to me. And I was shocked that A, Bubba didn't bark, and B, that shows up on my timeline every year, and it just cracks me up every
year.
Yeah. Because awesome. it's the best troll
yeah,
job.
That's an all timer.
Oh, it yeah. is. It's so good.
It's a good troll job.
But I am super excited when you text me today to tell me who was coming on. I was not aware of this gentleman's story. So I am super excited, so I'll let you introduce who our guest is tonight.
Yeah, our guest, a good friend of mine. We met, I want to say, almost a decade ago, pretty close. We've been friends ever since. And Frank's got a great story, and he fits in perfectly with what, you know, we're trying to do here. Former skinhead turned activist. You know, former addict. Well, I mean, I guess once you're an addict, you're always an addict. It's a recovering addict. Mm-hmm. And again, just an activist, a guy who's completely changed his outlook on life. Like, nobody's done more of a 180 than Frank. And we talk a lot about evolution and evolving as humans as we go on. And to me, nobody exemplifies this more. So Frank, thanks for coming on. Frank Meek, everybody.
Hey, thank you guys. Funny, I was listening to you guys talk, and as I was listening to you talk, I was thinking, wait, you get a choice to pick the team you want to be? I grew up less than a mile from the Eagle Stadium in Philly. You don't get a choice. It's Philly. So it's funny that you guys were mentioning that. I'm a diehard Flyers fan, and they won the cup the year I was born, and they haven't won it since. So,
oh my God, it's been that long.
Yeah, they won it in 75, and that was the year I was born. And I mean, I was probably a couple of days old when they won their last cup. And yeah, that's my team. That and Eagles are my team. So,
you know, it's
go ahead. Sorry.
It's funny that you say that you didn't have a choice, because I went to college with a guy that grew up in Philadelphia and was a diehard Cowboys fan. And then I ended up working with a guy who lived in Dallas, grew up in Dallas, and was a Giants fan. And I asked him, I said, how did you become a Giants fan? He's like, my family, we would watch the Cowboys. And at the time, Lawrence Taylor was really good. And I remember just watching Lawrence Taylor just dominate. And I turned around and looked at my dad and said, why aren't we rooting for that guy? He's so much better than everybody else. And he's like, ever since I became a Giants fan, I've been hated in my family the entire time. So.
Yeah, yeah. Dallas fans are hate, and, you know, that's our big rivalry, and both Giants and Dallas. But anyway.
I love you, though. It's weird, because as a Cowboy fan, the Eagles are probably the team that I don't like the most. But there's all these teams I'm supposed to hate that I never have, really. Like, I'm supposed to hate the Redskins, and I've just never given a shit. I've just never cared. And, like, I guess I'm supposed to hate the 49ers, and I never really have that much, you know? Or like the Celtics. I'm a Laker fan. I've never hated the Celtics. I never gave a shit. Like, I liked Larry Bird. I thought he was good.
That was like this year's Super Bowl. Like, I couldn't get myself to hate the Chiefs. During the game, like, I just don't hate the Chiefs. When, especially, I lived in the Midwest for a while. And anyway, I just couldn't hate them. I was like, I hope it's a good Super Bowl. It wasn't one of those ones. Like, I hope we killed them. I was like, man, I like those guys. So,
that's a weird evolution in life, isn't it? Like, that would have never happened in your 20s.
Yeah. No.
Like, I can go ahead and like not hate everything that's not what I like.
Yeah.
It's weird too, because you grow up and you can't even imagine. It's weird that somebody even roots for another team. Like, do you recall like seeing, like, I remember when I met the first people that I knew were openly like Iowa State fans, like when they first came out of the closet. I wish they would have stayed in. But when Iowa State fans first started coming out of the closet, like, I met these people, and it was just, it blew my mind. I didn't even think anybody rooted for them. It was so weird.
Well, it was weird to see people, if anyone be a Cowboys fan in our neighborhood. I'm sure there was one or two, or like a New York Rangers fan or somebody who was one of our competitors, or, but that was very weird. But it wasn't very often. They kept it to themselves.
Kind of like somebody that played soccer. Like, growing up in my neighborhood, somebody that played soccer. Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Like, I was a big soccer participant, Bill.
Were you?
I'm sure that'll shock you, right? Yeah.
Serious?
Yes, I played soccer when I was a kid, played soccer in high school, convinced the high school coach that I should be the goalie, because then I would only have to run within the 18-yard box, and I was super fat, and he bought it. So
nice, good for you.
Yeah, so.
So Frank, the real reason we have you on, obviously, is to kind of go tell your story a little bit, how you came to be where you are in kind of the your own kind of mental health journey, which I'm sure never ends, but where were you at mentally when you became a skinhead, so to speak? Like, where were you at mentally at that time, and how did you evolve?
Give it the whole little spiel about the beginning so you can understand, and most anyone would get this. Look, I came from two parents that were both kind of drug addict alcoholics. One lived in one neighborhood, one lived in another. I got shipped back and forth here and there. Just talking to my recovering rabbi today about this, about how I was like, when I was a kid, man, I just never, my mom, I lived most of my time with my mom when I was a younger child, and up until I was about 12 or 13. And, my mom wasn't a big, I love you guy, young person. Like, that just wasn't her deal. She never pulled me to the side and be like, I love you and I'm proud of you, or no, it just wasn't her deal. And some people are like that. My mom gets remarried to a guy, unbelievably, he just abusive, just, man, it was just living hell. He moved in when I was about 9 and, put his hands on me, physically, just mentally, just horrible to me. And eventually he got me kicked out of my mom's house when I was 13. I had to go move my dad. My dad lives up in Southwest West Philly. That's, you guys probably heard of West Philly. You're about my age a little bit, but you remember Fresh Prince of Bel Air, West Philly, born and raised on the playground where I spent most of my days. That's where I had to move. So Will Smith moved out and my white ass moved in to that neighborhood. Right. So went to an all black school, fist fought a lot. If I came home with a black eye, came home with anything, my dad wasn't type. My dad was a real little street brawler, had a little bar that he, did his little dealings out of the bar, and was a bartender there and managed a place, whatever. And so that was his whole life. I mean, he went there and opened up at 10 in the morning and came home at 3 or 4 in the morning. And, but if I came walking in with a black eye, it wasn't like, oh my God, are you okay, son? Are you all right? It was just like, shit happens. You know what I mean? That's just the way they were. So that's going on. And I'll tell you, man, like I was on welfare as a kid. I remember having to spend food stamps, the old food coupons, you know, and I remember having those. And man, that's embarrassing, man. No matter what, for a kid, it was embarrassing. For me, it was anyway. I don't know, maybe other kids were okay with it. I wasn't. And I remember having to go to store and having to pull those things out because you had to rip them out of the booklet to pay for the food. You couldn't have Lucy's because that meant you bought them illegally if they were Lucy's. Right.
Yep.
And so you had to rip it out of the book, pay the lady. And I'd say this all the time, but it was true, man. Every time I go rip them out of the book, you know, in a little corner deli in South Philly, you know who comes in that door right while you're doing it? The hottest girl in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, it's not, you're not balling. So, so, I mean, I've always had these little feelings of low self-worth, low self-esteem. And I don't know that at the time, you know what I mean? Just a 13-year-old kid who's getting abused at home at one and totally neglected at another. So that summer, man, I got to get up to the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area. And I went up there where my cousin lived, and he was involved in this neo-Nazi stuff. Now, race kind of played a part where I grew up. I grew up in an all-Irish Catholic neighborhood, my mom's, and then a kind of a mixed neighborhood with my dad's, obviously. And it was more of like a coffee mix. It was definitely a lot more darker than it was cream. So, but it was mixed. And so, but, you know, I'd heard, you know, we'd had, you know, it was an Irish neighborhood. We didn't like the Italians, which I'm half Italian. My last name was Bertolini, but it was my parents changed my mom changed my last name when she left my dad so we can live in an Irish neighborhood and I wouldn't be known as Frankie DeDego. So that's how crazy our neighborhood was. So they took Bertolini away, gave me Mink, which isn't even Irish, but as long as it wasn't a DeDego last name, it was cool. So and that's just the way it was. That was the way our neighborhood was. We didn't like the Puerto Ricans.
Like big cities on the East Coast were kind of generally that way. They're kind of segregated like that.
Yeah. And Chicago has big parts like that too. Yeah. You know what I mean? So in St. Louis had some that I remember. I mean, because I've been around the Midwest too. But, you know, growing up like that, it was, and so there was always just this kind of a race thing. You know, just, you know, keep them out of our neighborhood. We stay out of their neighborhood. And, so I go up to my cousins, and plus I just went to an all-black school where I'm fist fighting with black kids. Really rough school, rough little neighborhood, rough school. And so that summer I hear these guys, these neo-Nazi guys talking about multiracial society won't work. Man, I'm 14 years old. I'm just turning 14. I have no idea what you're talking about when you say multiracial. But when you start talking about blacks and whites whites and Puerto Ricans, oh, I got you. I know what you're talking about. And so, and the whole point of that is when I would hang out with these guys, man, these guys grew up around Amish people. If you've ever been to Pennsylvania, Lancaster's Amish. It's like the hub. That's their turf. You go bear. I might have lived in an Irish neighborhood. That's the Amish neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And those, you know, I mean, these weren't Amish neo-Nazis though. These were just white people that lived in that neighborhood or in that big county and stuff. So anyway, when I would hear them saying stuff like that, man, I would talk to them, these older guys who I thought were cool with tattoos and girls and cars and, you know, and they would always be like, man, what's it really like? So now I got these dudes asking me, what's it like in life? You know, I mean, for whatever reason, you know, I mean, I like that. Finally, someone's going, yo, how's life, Frank?
They think like you're kind of a hard ass because they're not around any black people.
Yeah, and they thought I was crazy and funny. I was the young.
Oh, you fight them because they were scared of them.
Right.
And that's you actually fight them?
Yeah. I remember this one girl asked me one time, I was saying about how I had to take the train, the trolley into school every day. And she tried to confront me in front of everyone. She was kind of drunk one night. And she's like, so you're going to tell me you take the trolley with black people every day? And I'm like, yeah, chick, I got to go through West Philly. Yeah, I go, yes. But imagine if I switched the situation and sat her down and be like, so you're going to tell me you see Amish people every day? You see horse and buggies every day? Yeah. You know, perspective of living. So I enjoyed that part. And then one night, man, and this is where the mental illness of this can kick in, and I think people will get this, is that when I would sit around and we were at nightclubs and all the neo-Nazis would all be meeting up, and I don't know all these other little neo-Nazi guys showing up, but they all know each other. And at the end of the night, man, the whole nightclub is scared of them. All the punk rockers, all the skaters, all the goth kids, everyone's scared of this group, and I'm with them. And that feels good.
Yeah.
That feels great, man, because up until that point, I might be a 14-year-old. I was an athletic kid. I was kind of a jock up until that point, too. I was really kind of like a 7 or 8-year-old mentally. You know, from when my stepdad moved in, man, I stopped growing mentally. And I just did. I'm physically, I was fine. Mentally, it was. So when I seen other people afraid of them, I was like, bet. I like this. You know, I was, you know, up until that point, I was scared of everything. I was scared of my school. I was scared of my parents, scared of my step parents, scared if I was going to have enough food to eat someday. And now someone fears me. All right. So that's kind of the first, you know, and then I just started buying into all the other issues. Right. So, you know, when they would sit around, I grew up and I remember hearing a lot of Jewish jokes. You know what I mean? Just, oh, how do you start a Jewish parade? You roll a penny down the street, or Jews always pick up the penny, or, you know, oh, I went to the store today and John didn't give me the right change back. He's always trying to Jew everybody, you know, blah, 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 blah. I always heard. And I remember as a kid not getting the joke and asking my uncle one time, like, why is that funny when you say Johnny tried to Jew you? And he said, oh, I remember him telling me, he goes, well, Frank, you know, the Jews are notorious for money. And he's like, you know what? You'll get it when you're older. I was probably maybe 10 at the time or whatever. He's like, you'll get that joke when you're older. It's funny. And I was like, all right. Well, I go to my first neo-Nazi group meeting with these guys, and they start talking about how the Jews secretly funnel money off the Federal Reserve to pay Israel, the da-da-da-da-da. And, yo, look, I'm 47 years old right now. I still don't know all the stuff the Federal Reserve does. So yeah. These guys, you know what I mean? Like, you, okay.
They don't, right. Yeah.
And then what that did to me when they said that.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah, man.
But it unlocked the joke. My uncle said, I'll get it when I'm older.
Yeah.
It unlocked it. I must be older now. I must know what the adults know. So I bought right into this stuff, and I got really, really into it. So my mental capacity of all this, and my definitely my mental, because all throughout my neo-Nazi years, I tried to suicide a couple times. I was already an alcoholic where I grew up. Alcohol, growing up in the Irish Catholic neighborhood in Philly, alcohol, there was no drinking age where I grew up. You could drink anytime, anywhere. People, you walk around drinking, they didn't, you know, no one ever, I mean, I never even, the drinking age issue when I got outside of the Philadelphia area was like, oh, you really abide by that rule? I'm like, really? It's fucking crazy. I could walk into a bar in my mom's neighborhood and say I was buying 2 quarts of beer for my mom, and they would not, they'd be like, okay. Like, that was really the way it was. So, but I was a hardcore alcoholic already. So, you know, low self-esteem, low self-worth. You know, this, the constant, in a way, it was a victim mentality. And it really was. It was just, everyone's always attacking me. And just full of fear all the time. But I don't know it. I'm masking it and all these other things. So I don't know it at the time. I wasn't, I had the capacity, a 14-year-old, to be like, Frank, you really have some self-esteem issues here, Frank. You know, because if you have true self-esteem, you don't have to hate others. You just feel good enough about yourself. And here's the last thing I'll say about that, because I became a really good recruiter in this white supremacist world. I was really good at it. I was always good at that. Like, God had given me some gifts. I was always good at, like, hey, let's get into this, let's do that. I was always good at that my whole life. Is that, man, when I would hear people talk about things like, man, I just want to be proud of my race. And you, everyone hears this stuff. You know, don't, you know, you're in a bar. Well, why can't I be proud to be white? They can be proud to be black. Why can't I be proud to be white? And then I'm like, yeah, man, that's what my group's all about. We're all about being proud to be white. Come hang out with my group. Come see what we're about. And then you come see what we're about. Guess what? When you come to our meetings, we don't ever talk about being proud to be white. We always talk about everybody else. Look at what they're doing.
Right.
Look at what they're doing. We don't ever, you can only talk about Leif Erikson so damn much. You know what I mean? So, you know, because other than that, the shit we talk about is all bad. I mean, we idolize Hitler. We idolize the South and the Confederate flag. And, you know, I mean, that's all the shit we really talk about when we do talk about our heritage. We don't talk about, like, the great, you know, the humanity that we, things that white people have done. I mean, you know, there's definitely things there. I'm not saying there isn't. It's a bait and switch. Oh, you want to be proud of your heritage? All right, well, come hate these people and you'll be proud of you. And it's just like our politics today. You know what I mean? And seriously, like,
100%. It's exactly how it's designed. It all goes to Nazi Germany. Like, how did Hitler convince all these people? Well, this is how he did it. Watch every politician right now. They do the same techniques. It's all the same shit.
Yep.
It's just packaged differently.
I can't tell you anything good that I'm doing. This is a politician. You know, I can't say anything that I'm doing or passing any laws that I'm passing, but look at what they might be doing to us.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you victimize a group and you put them at the blame of what your problems are, and that's the playbook that they used on you, that's the playbook that they use now. Whether it's transgender kids or you know, illegal aliens or whatever marginalized, whatever group that they want to put place blame on, and the other thing that I think that you said that I think is important is that I don't know that you necessarily felt powerful in that group. You felt safe. You had talked about being scared and whatever, and now you had a place that you finally felt safe.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then they used that fear of you not being safe, I think, to continue to extrapolate those views into you.
I don't think any of it. I don't think anyone's doing it though in that scientific of a way. I think it happens like that's how we all analyze it. Like when you look at everything and it's analytical, but I don't think that anyone makes that conscious decision where they're like, oh, look, this dude's afraid. Here, I'll make him unafraid. And now I'll be able to make him do whatever I want. I don't think anybody's actually doing that. I think it's just like this natural thing that like sociopaths have that they just do. And they don't even necessarily know it. It's like just the natural way that they handle things.
And a lot of the violence when, because I mean, there was tons of violence in this movie, obviously. I mean, I'm getting 15, I'm getting a swastika tattooed on my neck. I got tattoos on top. I have a tattoo on top of my head up here. You can't see it, but it says Made in Philly, which isn't racist. It's kind of just awesome, but I don't show it. Look a little crazy, but I have a tattoo up here that says Made in Philly. And I got them things when I was like 15, 16, you know, and I got those things, you know, and I look back on, it's because I wanted to look like the mean dog, you know what I mean? Don't look at me. And again, it's one of these things where, like, when I was getting people into this, you know, I was trying to explain to someone yesterday when we were talking about some of this stuff, where I said, because they were like, well, you know, you just wanted to be the bad guy. And I was like, you know what? What's funny is back then, I thought I was good. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? I really thought.
You're righteous.
Yeah. I'm saving the white race because this white race is dying out, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, fire truck's going by.
I'm serving a higher purpose. Like, that. You know, everybody wants to be a part of something that's bigger than themselves.
Yeah.
And then, but once you're a part of that thing that's bigger than you, I feel like you want to somehow be popular within that thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like you become a part of this religion that is great. Like you become a Scientologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're a Scientologist and all this cool shit is going on in your world, so you think now you want to be the Tom Cruise of Scientology. Now all of a sudden you want to be popular in the Scientology world. So like you get into the neo-Nazi world, now you want to be popular in that world. You want to like and that's what everybody does. They all want to move up in the thing. Like,
and this is too, and you're spot on, because when I was in the movement, it was before the internet. So this is the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I was getting cable access shows. That was the deal. That was the thing back then. You know what I mean? It's to get cable access shows to go on and talk about your beliefs for free. Mm-hmm. You're on the high numbers in your cable channel with the religious shows and all that stuff. But it was free. And
Yeah, you know, dude. I remember that shit here.
Today's podcast. You know what I mean?
Like, yep.
You know, everyone has a voice. And so... So I think of it too, like you were talking about Scientology. Another thing is like QAnon, you know what I mean? It's like they join this group and then they want to be an influencer and then they want to make all their tweets being read. They want to make all, you know, because I want people to believe what I'm believing. And it feels good when people agree with you or when you can get people to go, oh yeah, you know what? You're kind of right. You know, like
just endorphins.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's hard to believe JFK Jr.'s coming back or whatever it is, but whatever.
Right. But you should. Right. It's so much easier to find like-minded people for whatever it is. I mean, you know, with the internet, with everything else, you can. I think that's kind of where we're failing as a society, as a whole. This is where we're overcorrecting with the whole get rid of toxic people, get rid of the things that disturb your peace and blah, blah, blah. Well, what that does when you go 100% that direction, all of a sudden now we're avoiding conversation. Now we're not talking to people that don't think like us and we're not coming to agreements. We're not making compromises. We're just going, fuck you. You're an asshole because you don't think like me. Go away forever.
Well, like, and the only information you're getting is the same information that you already believe.
Yeah,
that you have no outside influence whatsoever or different ideas when you shut yourself off like
that. Well, like Frank, you know, Frank, for example, doesn't do you any good to talk to a bunch of people who are reformed like yourself. Like what you want to do is talk to the people that need reformation.
Right.
Oh, like, yeah. You know,
but so, and, well, the good thing is though, when, cause there is a lot of us reformed informers who stick, who are all friends and we made networks
of
together.
Course. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And the most powerful thing is, we could talk about this too, with the mental illness, man, is when you get around people and you get the medical me too moments, you know, and I'm not taking away from the women's me too moments. Right. I'm
right.
Talking about like the rooms of recovery. They're the rooms of recovery are original me too moments, right? A guy comes in, man, I was drinking and driving my kids in the car. I got in trouble. Everybody hates me. What's the people in the room say? Yeah. Me too, buddy.
Yeah. Yep.
Yep, me too. Come sit and talk. Let's talk about this. When everyone else wants to be like, yo, get away from me, you scumbag. You're drinking and driving. Even though they might be doing it, but whatever.
Yeah.
They might be Zanny's driving, whatever. You know, whatever everyone wants to look down on. So that's one of the things. And so even when you're talking to a former or a guy who's just getting out of the neo-Nazi stuff, which I do, you know, counsel guys and some girls, but mostly men, you know, it's when they're talking about how they hate it like this and everyone else is like, ew. And I'm always like, yeah, man, me too. I used to believe that. I used to believe that too. Oh my God. Exactly. I used to believe that same exact way. And, yeah. And it's when you have those conversations with people and you do the, you know, me too, man, you see their shoulders just go, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Like, I'm not that crazy. Right. Like,
right.
Did believe this. Someone else did do this, and that's what this whole world for me in my life, that with the work I do today, that's what it's all about, is getting a person to be like, oh, okay, like I can talk about this.
It's trauma bonding. It's just a different. It's you know, you're dealing with somebody who had the same belief system, right? And you guys are kind of, you know, the same thing happens with someone who's a victim of sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you speak with someone else who's also been a victim of sexual abuse, and everybody else on the outside, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you? Well, only another victim understands why you didn't say anything.
Yeah.
The shame that you felt and this, that, and the other thing. And that, to me, is why the conversations always need to be had. I think that we're doing the opposite of what we should be doing now. We're running away. We're continuing to run away from conflict and run away from uncomfortable conversations, you know, and just like when I'm telling someone, I'm arguing with someone about the trans community, right? Like, let's say I'm basically saying to them, like, this doesn't affect your life. You know, why not just talk to someone that believes differently than you? Well, for every person that I'm saying that to, I'm also talking to someone who is on the same team as me when it comes to the trans movement, trans team, who just refuses to talk to this Trump supporter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just because they're a Trump supporter, it's like, dude, maybe find out why. But why does your empathy only work in one direction?
Right. Absolutely.
I don't understand this.
And that's, you know, and that's when I was talking about the violence, like a lot of the violence, people will think, wow, did you go out and just beat up black people, or did you go out and just do things to Jewish people? Not most of our violence was against the left. Like, I mean, I went to prison for kidnapping an Antifa member. That's what I went to prison for. That's my conviction. You know what I mean? So it was like a lot. So it's, you know, it's really crazy and a skirted line of, you know, was we really for the white race? And, you know, because if anyone disagreed with us, that was our enemy. It wasn't just minority person or this or that. It was, and again, it's because I had to enforce my will and my ego on others.
Mm-hmm.
You don't believe what I believe, rawr, you know?
Well, and you're also kind of going radical versus radical in that sense.
Yeah, a little bit, you know.
And, you know, and that's where we're at. It's the squeaky wheel always getting the grease, you know? Like, because the radical on either end of the spectrum is the smallest number, but they're the ones that are the loudest.
They're the loudest. Yep. I go back to kind of what you said about, at the time you believe what you're doing is right and things like that. And I think that sometimes puts us in that pigeonhole of not being able to see other people that, you know, I don't want to keep going to this group, but the group that infiltrated the Capitol and broke into the Capitol. In their minds, I don't think that they, in their mind, thought that they were bad people or that they were specifically going there to be violent. They really believed that that what they were doing was right.
Absolutely.
And you watch some of these videos and interviews and these people talk and they truly and utterly believe what they're saying. And somebody on the outside looks at that and goes, they're crazy. But I might look that way to them, even though I might, when history decides itself, I don't know, might be on the right end of it. I look just as crazy to them as they do to me. So how do you get past that, Frank? How do you get past that?
So what I do is, I like to bring up, we want to go down the route of, people wanting to make red states and blue states now and the Civil War or trying to make a homeland up in Idaho and all that stuff is, here's the truth. And this is what I know is that in 300 years from now, like, we're going to be one color. Like, we're merging and we're constantly merging. You have people that are of different races having children and those people then have children with other. And in 300 years from now, we're going to be not so white, right? Like, it's just the truth. And that's what history, for me, is what we're going to say is, they're going to look back on all this stuff and be like, holy crap, we went through all this. Like, I try to talk to people about, like, what the future of this, really what the future is. There is no home white land. It's not like this is going to be forced on each other. This is naturally going, like, the people talk about the great replacement theory. Like, they truly believe that. And the fact is, all of us are going to be replaced. Everyone's getting replaced. It's what happens. We die. And for the people that are listening to this and say, well, I ain't letting my daughter marry such and such persons. That's great. Maybe they won't because of your racism, but wait until you see who your grandchildren bring home. Wait until you see who your great-grandchildren bring home. And do you want to be that old, grouchy, old, racist grandfather that the grandson thinks he has to hide his girlfriend from you? Because guess what? We're mixing and merging. We're Americans. It's too late to stop it. There's nobody that can stop it. Even if they have their own little white homeland that'll last for 10 years, the truth of all this is hate's always got to hate. So if they get their own homeland, they're going to split up once they get in there because you're a Protestant, you're this, da, 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 and you're not conservative or whatever, or you're not liberal. And not really.
You're going to split up within that community.
Because hate's got to hate. Hate's got to hate. And so that's where I go with people when I talk to them about, like, the future of this country and what I know for a fact is going to happen. It's just true. I mean, it's evolution. It's fine. Are we going to be on the side of history that says, all right, we need to fix some of this stuff, I don't want to get into all my activism, but I'll just bring it up because I want to really talk about mental illness. But really, my activism goes like this, and this is the truth, and I hope people start to listen. We have 34% of the world's women's prison population, and we're only 4% of the world's population. Most of them women are women of color and poor whites, right? It's a fact. That is horrendous. That is horrendous. And for people go, well, they're all convicted of crimes. They should be. No, that's not mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is the building and the maintaining of the county jail systems of America. That is, those numbers of how many people are in county jails to what's upstate is different now. There's more people in county jails than there are in upstate prisons now because it's become a moneymaker. It's a profit. No lie. Every time you sleep in a county jail, I've been there a couple of times, the local sheriff's department gets money for you being in there. And it's become this whole big rigmarole. And like, when we look at this later on, when we are, becoming more, hopefully more enlightened people, which I do see in our future, we're going to look back on that and go, oh, that was the wrong side of history. I get it. You know what I mean? So, and when I break that stuff down to Americans and, in the other part where I could talk to, so there's a lot of cop watching. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it, the auditing, the police auditing and I'm real involved with a lot of that community. And here's the great thing is, man, that community is right wing, that community is left wing, it's big center, and they all share each other's videos and they all support each other, and it's becoming bigger and bigger and bigger, and the police can't stop it. They're trying to make some laws to try and they can't because we have this Bill of Rights. So what's funny is this one thing that's having real effect on policing is coming from both sides. the auditing world is big time right wing. It's big time like constitutional, da da da. And a lot of the cop watching is left. Is like, yo, these are abusing us. I'm going to stand as close as the people that stood to George Floyd. I'm going to stand that close to you and video you now from now on. Mm-hmm. And it's starting to have an effect. And it's both groups combined, and they're sharing each other's videos. So once we start feeling that there's really something wrong, the activists, because all those people that think, oh, they're troublemakers. Those cop watchers are just troublemakers. You know who else they said that about? The people that dumped the tea in the Boston Harbor. Started the Boston, that unfortunately ended with the Boston Massacre. Even people that were Americans and not loyalists to Britain were going, come on, guys, why are you starting this trouble? That's the same thing that's being said about these cop watchers and stuff now. And it's getting bigger and bigger because people are just done. They're done. Like, we're done with getting pulled out of cars for not using a blinker, especially if you're of color. Like, we're just done with it. And we are going to get these reforms. And that's the stuff later on our history is going to look back and go, that was American. That was American. And a lot of people are getting it because on the right wing, like the Trumpers are all like against the FBI now and against their stuff. And we're like, no, let's combine it. It's this abuse of law enforcement, federally and non-federally, that is causing this mass incarceration, this everyone's got to be in the system. And for the people that say, you know, because it's all about like traffic stops and it's all about pulling people from cars, it's all about, you know, I mean, imagine this, and this is real in this country, especially if you are a person of color, that if you don't use your blinker 200 feet before the stop sign, only 175 feet, or if you used it too early, because I've heard cops use it as you put it on too early because you're paranoid and scared I'm going to pull you over, so now you're being shady, so you put it on a 300 feet, and that makes my cop sense tingle, and I see you have dirt on the floor, and that looks like weed shake. And now, because you didn't use a blinker, you're in handcuffs, you have your kid in the back seat of the car, you're in handcuffs, and they're searching your car, and this is the country we call freedom. Right. So anyway, that's where when I get to talking to these people on the right that aren't part of this activism, that's part of the cop watching community and all that, they all get it. They do. And on top of that, I've testified in front of the United States Congress. I've been, you know, during the pandemic, I was called in to go testify about neo-Nazi cops. Not that they're all neo-Nazis, but I was a neo-Nazi and we were told to become cops, and a bunch of my guys became cops. So I went and testified and said, here's one, there's one, here's another. Oh, that guy, yeah, I used to hang out with him. He used to be all about race war. Now he's a sergeant in the Philadelphia Police Department. Oh, yeah, that's kind of crazy, isn't it? Now he gets to pull black people out of their cars and he has these beliefs. Again, not all cops have it, but the point is that they have the power. So when I bring it down to people like that, man, they get on board. And that's what my activism is all about. Now, because this was talking about, and I hope that good, I'm going to transition over to mental illness because I've been excited.
No, you're fine. It all goes together.
Because one of the things that builds my self-esteem is standing up for others.
Yeah.
Because it's all about others, right? It's all about doing for others, seeing that there's an injustice and standing. It helps my self-esteem and my low self-worth because I'm like, hey, I'm just going to use my voice to speak for others. Yeah. When I was a neo-Nazi, it was all about my fear of what I'm losing, right? And now it's like, no, I see things happening to other people. And if I could just use my voice and say, hey, I don't like this. And that's what our First Amendment's all about. Anyway, it's all about activism. It's not just freedom of speech. It's freedom petitioning your government, freedom of press, freedom of religion, you know, and freedom to gather. Like, it's the First Amendment's all about being an activist. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, I just think that I think you and I have had kind of a similar evolution in that way, where, you know, it's that you have that nature versus nurture thing, you know, growing up the way you grew up, it drove you into this, the neo-Nazism, you know, fighting black kids all the time. You know, you had this us against them mentality for the longest time. And when you were talking to like-minded people, especially, it was validated. It was constantly validated. And so then your worldview gets basically shaped that way. Mm-hmm. But then, now you're looking at things that have never happened to you. You're listening to other people's stories, and you can say to yourself, I can understand why that person thinks that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand now why that is an injustice where I didn't before.
Right.
Because I think that's what we all have to do, because we forgive people. We tend to forgive people for their worldview and their values being shaped by their experience. And maybe we should stop doing that a little bit, and we should be leaning more towards thinking about everyone's experience. Like, your worldview shouldn't just be shaped on what you've experienced yourself. I don't think enough emphasis is put on it. I don't think it's described that way enough.
Yeah. And you're right. And this, to stay on the topic with that, is, you know, when we want to quote, I got people hanging out my window here in LA. you know, like, we got, you know, when people want to now quote Martin Luther King, right? And great mm-hmm. Black leader. They want to quote, you know, James Baldwin, Fred Hampton. You got Huey Newton, Malcolm X, right? You have all these great Black leaders, and they all talked about one thing pretty consistently, and that was police brutality. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not lying to us. Like, right. They're not lying, right? You know what I mean? Like, this has been an ongoing, oh my gosh, I'm standing right there just yelling right in my window.
like, it's a live show, sure. Frank. It's fine.
Hola.
It's the LBC.
LBC. So, you know, and that's the other thing. Like, I started to listen, like, right? Because, I can go on and on about this, man. It's been my life for the last, you know, good 5 years where I really dedicated myself to this situation. But, you know, like, we're just not listening. And it's like,
yeah,
we
noticed.
Start to listen, right? And here's the great thing, and talk about recovery and all this stuff. So is, you know, we had prohibition and then throughout the whole 20s, you know, in the 1920s and into the 31 or whatever when we lifted it. In 1931, we finally decide to reenact. It's the only amendment that we go against in all of the Constitution. There's the 18th Amendment, which was prohibition, and the 21st Amendment, which is the lifting of prohibition. So you can always remember that, because 21 is a legal age to drink, but the 21st Amendment is where we lift the 18th Amendment. And it was for three reasons, man. The government wanted to make money off of booze, the people wanted to drink, and police brutality. They were going in speakeasies and beating the shit out of people and beating up the town drunks all the time. And, you know, going into, you know, they were doing it to Black people for a long time, but we didn't give a shit. But then when they started doing it to the college kids speakeasies and all that, then we were like, whoa, 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 whoa here.
Yeah.
Right. And now here's what's great, man, is they lift that on the third, on I think it was, no, 1933. And then only 2 years later, this group called, and just to put it out, the group called Alcoholics Anonymous was founded only 2 years later, right? Because Americans will fix things. We will. We have that in us. They'll be like, so we knew that alcohol was becoming a problem. There were asylums being filled with alcoholics at the time, and they couldn't stop these men and women from drinking. So they started giving them lobotomies. Like, that's where we were as a country, right? And now here's, we finally lift the prohibition. It gets legalized. So now that we can, colleges and professors and researchers started researching how to really start fixing this thing and look at things. But then it was really just two men talking to each other about their problem that started. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous, just historically here, I'm not talking for any reference of just historical here, is one of the last, will be one of the greatest things that America is known for. Like, that group has helped millions of people around the world, millions, get their families back, get their sobriety back, get their lives back, husbands back, wives back. And it's in 66 different languages, and it's free. It's free. Mm-hmm. America did that. Because we lifted the oppression off of us, we were able to start a group that is now one of the most, it actually, Time Life magazine said is, the most spiritual, the most spiritually founded group in the last 100 years is this group called Alcoholics Anonymous, which then later on forms all these other 12-step groups: Narcotics Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Debtors Anonymous, mm-hmm. Gamblers Anonymous. All because we lifted the oppression off of the people. And now, when we could do that, legalize marijuana. We should legalize marijuana. Give up on this stupid fucking drug on war, which is really just a war on poor people. Anyway, these are the things, man. When you talk to other Americans about being proud to be American, and they went, you know, America. Yeah, well, that's one of the greatest things. We will, AA and the Alcoholics Anonymous will be in American history 200 years from now. Like, it's going to still be around. It's going to be this, because it just will. It's only 100 years old, and it has helped millions of people around the world with the people saying, me too. So anyway,
I think that's a good, like, that's actually a good overall message if you think about it, just kind of in general, that as Americans, we tend to self-correct. Like we, for the most part, we will self-correct societally without people making us do it, without having to make laws necessarily or whatever. But that's also something we can think about ourselves, I feel like, with our own mental health. Like when we're going through it, when it's a tough time, tough week, tough day, think about that within yourself. Like, I will self-correct. I tend to self-correct for the most part. Like, no matter what I'm doing, no matter what's going on, I find a way to self-correct in the end, whatever that, whatever I come to, I will get there. It's kind of that this too shall pass type of attitude.
Right. Yep.
And see, my mental illness, because I have this disease, it's a brain disease, it's this addiction, alcoholism, whatever you want to call it, I definitely have it. And I have to work on it every day. And it doesn't just mean I might slip up drinking. No, like, I have issues where, like, if someone pisses me off, I send nasty text, right? Like, I'm just one of those, I tend to bark and growl when I talk. I just do. I was a hockey coach for a long time. You know all this stuff, Bill. You know, I tend to bark and growl when I talk. Like, it's just the person I am, and it's part of my disease in a way. But you know, sending that last email to the coworker, it's like, fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get to do that stuff today. Like, I don't. I don't get to send those texts. Like, fuck you then. How dare you not talk to me with respect? Like, I have to watch that stuff in my life today. Because that is part of my mental illness. And the thing that I have to remember, for one, everyone is a child of God and they don't deserve those texts. They just don't. And that's still hard for me to stop myself from doing it. But the other is to getting that emotional hangover tomorrow when I wake up and go, oh, God, now that's there's another relationship gone. And that's all due to my mental illness, because I think you didn't treat me right. Right. And this goes back to my alcoholism, but also back to my growing up. Like, you know, I have abandonment issues. My parents abandoned me. You know, I'd be dating a girl and I'm like, she probably was with Big Dick John before me. I'm probably not good enough. And then that sits on my head. And next, you know, she might, you know,
pretty soon you push her right into Big Dick John.
Yeah. Because I, you know, it's like, and I can't control it. And it's like, instead of just thinking, it is what it is, like, you know, whatever. Like, I mean, that's my mental illness. That's the stuff that it does to me. And so I'm grateful that I have a recovering rabbi in my life that I get to talk to. I talk to him every morning because I have to go to another man to get outside perspective sometimes, because for 45 years, guys, I lived my life even out of the neo-Nazis when I kept slipping in and out of drugs and alcohol. I mean, I only have 4 years now. I was been going to the rooms of recovery for over 25 years and I only got 4 years. So I've done some damage in and out, right? Coming in and out until I finally realized I got accepted. I have this disease. It actually drives me insane sometimes, where I, you know, again, it's not just the drinking and using, but it's this constant thought of self. Because when I think about myself, somehow because of the disease, whatever it might be, and I think it's with a lot of people, though, when I think about myself too much, low self-esteem slips in, you know, low self-worth, and then my ego comes in, and then now I'm becoming harmful, now I'm becoming, you know, toxic to people, and that's what I gotta watch. And when I have another man go, You're acting a little crazy right now, Frank. Let's work on this. Let's take, well, we take it to God a lot, but you know, let's work on it. Let's identify that, you know, that person's not doing shit to you personally. They're not out there going, let me get Frank today. You're just taking everything that way. You know what I mean? Because everyone's going through their own life. And see, and I'm the type of person where if someone even says one little thing, here's a good example. Back in the day, I hear someone go, man, that Frank's crazy. So then I call them, how fucking dare you, I'm crazy. Yeah. I'm calling him, sounding more crazy.
Yeah,
him crazy.
The fact that you called him was crazy.
Yeah, because I'm going to convince them that I'm not.
Right.
Crazy,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. And I just look more crazy.
Yeah.
And today, man, if I take it back a little bit, take that breather, go to my sponsor, go to my recovering rabbi, talk about things that I need to know about, and, you know, and really identify some problems where, you know, sometimes I'm just delusional about the whole situation, or I'm very self-seeking. Like, I wish you would say this to me. How am I going to make other people say what I want to me?
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't love me enough. She didn't say I love you at the right time when I made her breakfast, and now she didn't. And when I asked her to love me, she just said, mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Frank, that hits so close to home, because Bill and I have had this conversation in the last few weeks about what I've been talking to my therapist about, or whatever, is managing my expectations that I expect other people to have, and they don't measure or meet up to what I expect them to be. And what you just said is the exact thing that I am battling right now. I mean, I may make a gesture or whatever to my wife, and if she doesn't act, you know, the way that I think it should be, then I
didn't read her line in the script that you had written in your head.
And then I'm disappointed. And then I'm moody, and then I'm upset, or I'm sad, or somebody didn't answer back the way I want in the timely manner that I wanted them to. And now I'm upset and whatever. And I need to learn and realize that their reaction wasn't wrong. It's just the way that they do things.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sometimes.
And it's my own damn fault sometimes.
Well, I could, what I hear too, like the major issue is almost like sometimes a failure to compartmentalize, because, you know, like what Frank's talking about, and I think the two of us both have this, is this inflated sense of justice to where it goes beyond just something being as being able to say something simply like, you know, well, life's just not fair. Well, you can't just say that about everything or nothing ever gets done, right? So that sense of injustice and that making us so angry and making us want to fight against whatever injustice that is the same thing that gets us sending that text for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where we're saying, you know, you didn't say this to me the right way, so now I'm gonna fucking attack you.
Yep.
But that sense of injustice is also what makes you fight for people that don't have a voice.
Yep.
So you have to compartmentalize because it's a positive attribute, and now and then it manifests itself negatively when you get in that situation.
Or when, if my, you know, my girl doesn't say the right thing to me, or my kids seem disrespectful to me for whatever reason, and now it's in my head all day, right? And now I start to build on it.
Yeah.
And then you know who I take it out on? The woman at the grocery store who's taking too long groceries. That's where I'm like, and it's like these little issues that if I would address them, you know, not with the person, but with my outside counsel to be like, hey, you know, and again, like you said, it's, you know, if a person doesn't hug me the right way, and maybe they don't want to be hugged like that, you know, just using it as an example, you know what I mean? It's, and then again, you have to look, maybe that person has issues with the connection or whatever, you know what I mean? And it's like, I have to take it that, you know, that's the way they do their thing, and that's the way they live their life. And, you know, I'll tell you when
he doesn't want our dicks to touch when we hug. Yeah. Like maybe and, that guy just ain't into that.
Like, and I know that, like, we just reached the globe just reached 8 billion people. And I think before I was cool, like, I was cool trying to control 7 billion people. But once it got to 8, I was like, that's too many. And I had to stop trying to control everybody. You know what I mean? eight was too much. 7, I can kind of control those.
7 worked.
Because especially when I future trip, if I sit around on a future trip and start thinking about, you know, man, people start to become my enemies in my head. Probably. I mean, he's probably too jealous of me, and he'll probably say this instead of that, or da 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 da. And it's like I start to think like that sometimes when I sit by myself and think about myself. That's the great thing about that you were saying about the activism is I think about others, and it's the same thing. Like, and I hope that anyone listening to this don't think I'm anti-cop because I worked a lot with police. I've done a lot of work with police. I'm not anti-cop. I'm not the fund the police guy. You know, I let's fund them homicide divisions, fund them rape divisions, fund them credit card theft divisions. So like, let's catch those bad guys. I'm not anti-police. You know what I mean? So it's that's another thing. My activism isn't like all cops are bad. You know, it's not that. It's just some of the processes that's going on. You know what I mean? Like, they're still human beings. They're still children of God. They're trying to do the job, and they think that what they're doing is right. You know, and I think of it that way. I come at it a lot differently than going, you are horrible. Like, you hear from some activists, you know what I mean? It's just, so.
Well, it's fear. Cops are always dealing with people on their worst day, pretty much 100% of the time. So,
and the drunks, man. That's what I think. Cops deal with a lot of drunks, a lot of domestic violence.
Exactly. A lot of domestics. Yeah.
I mean,
a lot of cops.
They also see dead bodies in cars before we do. Yeah. And they get PTSD before we do because they have to cover up bodies so that we don't see them. You know what I mean?
Right, like, right.
You know, that shit is
real. Well, there's, and I also, you know, a lot of white cops, the only time they're in a black neighborhood is at work.
Mm-hmm.
So you combine that with the fact that they called the cops. Cops are there for a reason. So if somebody's having a bad day, and so your only experience with black people is on their worst day. But you know, you grew up around nothing but white people. You know plenty of white people that you've seen them have a bad day, but you knew they were a good person otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And you could say to yourself, well, that guy just had a bad day.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
Uncle so-and-so. He had a tough day.
Yep.
But when you go, the only time you're ever in a black neighborhood and the only time you know any of these people is when there's a bad day happening, you think that's what they're like every day.
Yeah. And anytime cops are pulling over black people for a blinker, that's a bad day. So that makes the bad
day. Well, yeah, 100%. But yep. I'm just saying, like,
if I
were to telling, it's like we've been talking about this whole time, telling these cops that they're horrible shithead people doesn't make them stop being horrible shithead people. Mm-mm. What makes them stop is having that conversation. When you say to them, like, hey, maybe put this in a little perspective. And I would almost guarantee there's someone in the police force having that conversation with other policemen.
No,
you know, saying to them, hey, this is their worst day. You need to keep this in mind, you know.
And just so you know, like a lot of that, because I do my own podcast, the Frank Mink Show, just to throw out a little plug. And I've been getting word back that cops have been listening, right? And they're and my other activism stuff, some of the articles I've helped write and got put out and stuff. And I'm telling you, man, there are cops going, yo, keep doing what you're doing. Like, because it's not going to change. And it's not going to change from the inside. Cops can't.
And I've said this 100 times that, and I know a few police officers, the good police officers want those bad ones gone just as much as you and I do.
They try to vet them. That's the thing.
Yes, absolutely.
But what people don't understand is you can't vet a sociopath. A sociopath knows how to get through your vetting process.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there's no, this is something, these guys that end up being racist and adrenaline junkies and beating the shit out of people, there's no vetting for someone like that. There's no vetting for that personality. You have to wait. You literally have to wait for it to manifest itself.
Right.
The point is, when it manifests itself, you get rid of the motherfucker. Like, you don't cover it up.
Their union stop, but their union.
Exactly. Actually, you don't cover it up.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what, that's
you don't do. FOP. You don't do the organized crime thing. You fucking fire. You get rid of the guy.
Yep. Listen, we're gonna hop in here, take a break. This has been a super great discussion, Frank. When we come back, though, I would like to pivot a little bit and talk about when you started to quote see the light and move beyond that. So let's get a quick word from our sponsor, Revelton Distilling Company. From Osceola, Iowa, and then we'll come back with Frank Mead.
At Revelton Distilling Company, everyone has become a part of the Revelton family. From the tailors and their daughter who helped perfect their award-winning gins, to the team who installed Lucy, our 33-foot-tall custom-made still, right down to the local farms that provide our coveted corn, and even the cows on those farms who consume our mash byproduct. Want to see the farm-to-flask come to life? Now you can tour Lucy and find out where we take Iowa's harvest and transform it into our finest spirits. Choose between a 45-minute tour or find out even more by scheduling a VIP behind-the-scenes tour to get the taste of the full Revelton experience. You can visit them at 1400 West Clay Street in Osceola, Iowa, or find all of Revelton's award-winning spirits at any local grocery or spirits retailer.
All right, and we are back. A huge thanks to Revelton Distilling Company from Osceola, Iowa. We are joined with Frank Mink, activist and former skinhead.
Looks like Bill. Frank's taking a piss or something.
Yep. Frank took a break here. So, but Bill, your point about them wanting to vet people out, I think is an important part to that discussion.
Well, it is, because I, again, two sides to every story, two sides to everything, you know, and you can't be a person that only lets that work in one direction. It has to go both directions or nothing gets done and nothing changes. So you, if I don't think that people know what links they go to or how hard they try to vet out those type of people. But again, like we said before, that stuff's not vettable. So, I mean, I'll give you a great example. I got a DUI, I want to say about 12 years ago, right? And part of that process, I got it out of state. I got it in South Dakota. So I didn't have to do the thing the way they do things here where you stay in the hotel for two nights and the whole jail. I didn't have to do that. Right. I could just go. I took a class and then I had to get a substance abuse evaluation, right? So the substance abuse evaluation, basically that guy decides if you need to seek actual treatment or if he says like, you're okay. You don't like have this kind of problem, like basically you know, high risk to reoffend, so to speak. Right. So they ask you all these questions about how often you drink and how often you've done other drugs and all this stuff. Well, I lied my way through that entire fucking thing because I knew if I answered it truthfully, he'd probably make me go to treatment. Right. So, like, you think a guy in the police academy that wants to fucking get his rocks off is a neo-Nazi or whatever? You think he can't fucking lie on the test? You think he doesn't know what he's supposed
right.
to do? That somebody else hasn't already gone through it and says, hey, you got to say this and this and this when they ask you this and this and this. I mean, it's just going to happen. There's going to be people that get through there. And again, get rid of those fucking guys. Don't cover it up. That's really, I think, all anybody's asking.
Yeah. 100%. 100%. Frank, we took a break, but before we took that break, I wanted to pivot and dive a little bit into, you've talked about where you were before and being a part of that skinhead movement. Let's talk about the beginnings of where you started to see that maybe you wanted to change and where you were wrong.
Yeah. So some of it started in prison. When I went to prison at 17, kind of hung out just by chance. I was in the state of Illinois and, you know, in the county jail there was like no gang affiliates. Everyone's just waiting trial. And I made a couple friends in there. And then I wound up running back into them upstate when I got sent upstate. And a couple of them guys were just really cool and down. Now, again, this is an American History X where I changed in the prison. It didn't never happen. But I remember being in there and noticing just like, man, some of these dudes are just good dudes, you know? And so I remember when I got out of the prison, I started thinking on the Black, Asian, and Latino issue. I was like, you know what, man, we're all equal, man. Like kind of we're all kind of fucked here because I watched the prison system grow from, this is in the 90s, and that's when mass incarceration was really getting into its full. And I was like, wow, this, you know, they were giving young brothers.
We're all poor, I know.
Yeah. And right. I kidnapped a lefty guy, and I got 3 years, and I know another guy that stabbed a crackhead in the leg who was trying to rob him, and he got like 15 years. You know what I mean? So so anyway, I seen a little bit of how the difference was on race a little bit, even though I'm in there with all my Aryans, still doing all my Aryan stuff, still trying to believe that stuff. And when I got out from prison, I was like, you know what? I'm still gonna kind of be down for this thing, and because that's where I had all my clout, that's where I had all my pull, that was where I got all my ego fed, and you know, people respected me. I went to prison, I shut my mouth, I did the right things, you know, whatever.
Identity crisis.
Yeah, but so then I was like, you know what, I'm just gonna preach against the Jews, because that's what I've been trained mostly in. Now I was like, I'm just gonna preach against that, and I'll, you know, whenever I'm around, I just stick to that topic, because I really, you know, what I started here was I would go around like a lot of the new guys that were getting into the movement, and they would try to talk to me and impress me. And I was kind of the older time, even though I was only like 18 or 19, but I'd been around. And so guys would say things, you know, like, oh, black people are this. And I would just think, and it just in the back of my mind, I'm not like saying to them, but I remember just looking at them going, you sound like a fucking idiot. Like, that's not... Right. But then what I would think about, too, it was even crazier, is when they would say these things, I would think, you know what, when I was his age and I was just getting in, I used to say those same things and thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
Right. I was
like, wow. Yeah.
You know, I was like, wow, this is fucking stupid. And then trying to find a job, and you know, had a big swastika on my neck, you know, aggravated kidnapping on my record. Things ain't going good, whatever. And this Jewish man gave me a job working at an antique show. And he was like, I don't give a shit what you believe, just don't break my furniture. And I worked for this man, and he was just a really, really good man who taught me a lot. And he wound up hiring me full time, and just was this really just good, good man. And he used to say things to me like, if I broke something, it goes back to the mental illness. When I make a mistake, and I still do this to this day, man, when I mess up a little bit, I go, oh, I'm stupid. You know what I mean? Like, I have a learning disability. I have dyslexia. So it's hard for me to read sometimes, even though I've written books and stuff now. I still have this issue sometimes, and it really pops up sometimes, like, where I have some learning disabilities and dyslexia, and I accept that in myself. But I also sometimes go, man, you're so stupid. You know, and so one time I was in front of Keith, and I said, man, I'm so stupid. And he said, stop saying you're stupid, you fucking idiot. It's like, you're one of the smartest people I ever met. And he said these words to me that have stuck with me from that day on. And this is like one of the moments, you know, he just said, he looked at me very seriously and said, Frank, smart people can fake being dumb, but dumb people can't fake being smart. You just are. And I was like, wow. And that was the like final last moment day where I was like, I got to stop. I just to be part of this thing, I'm like believing shit that I know isn't true anymore. Right.
Right.
So, guys, from there, I went on and did a bunch of shit, man. I did, in fact, the Oklahoma City bombing happened shortly after I got out of the movement. So I went to the FBI, and that's what, again, back to that I worked with law enforcement. You know, I wasn't like a snitch or an informant. I just got out and was like, yo, I want to help. And I went to the FBI right after Oklahoma City bombing and said, yo, like, I know everyone that wanted to do this. I know people, you know, at the time, there was people that are still rumored to be connected to Timothy McVeigh that were my homies, like guys I ran with. Because there was guys I was running with that were robbing banks. Like I said, we were kidnapping people, robbing banks. We were doing all types of stuff. And but I was just like, man, I wanted to help stop. So I went and built hockey programs in the city of Philly called Harmony Through Hockey with the Philadelphia Flyers. So now I'm like this hometown kid with my favorite team, got a job. You know, as I put things about others in front of myself sometimes, things were successful. Now, again, I still had the disease of addiction and alcoholism hardcore at that time, so I was not sober at the time. But, you know, I still got the light. I still got the feel, like, oh, when it's for others, right? So I did that for years. Then I moved to Iowa, guy, as some of you, Billy knows, because that's how we met. You know, I moved to Iowa, did the same thing, built hockey programs, became a hockey coach, not just coaching black kids or, you know, minority kids at hockey. I actually became a really good hockey coach because that's kind of the person I am, and started coaching AAA teams and helping out with AAA teams and moving on in that coaching career, because coaching hockey was just like coaching a gang. You know what I mean? You have your enforcers, you have your grinders, you have your stay-at-home guys, you have all that shit. You know what I mean? So I got really good at coaching, won a bunch of national championships for Iowa. With all that being said, man, my addiction and my disease and my mental illness would keep popping back up. And so about 4 years ago, because I'm coming up on 4 years now, about 5 years ago, I would say, I started relapsing again. Things weren't good. And, you know, I had a wife at home, and a lot of bad things were starting to come out about both of us that really was hurting our... It basically broke our marriage up, my using, and I don't talk about her because, you know, we're friends now, we're great friends now, which is a good thing, but, you know, she's not here to tell her side of the story, but there was things that just were happening, right, and you guys get it, and things that really, really hurt, and I, again, basically on my own, because it's not about other people, it's about myself, when it comes to these problems, is I basically burnt every, I built a big, beautiful future up again for my family and my loved ones, and I burned it all down again. And so, just to tell you where the light, the real light that happened, and was I was at getting a divorce, got arrested for a no contact. I didn't know violence or anything like that. I just got done refereeing a hockey tournament so I could see my kid, because I was pulling like a ghetto Mrs. Downfire here. I like there was a no contact. And, when the no contact was happening, I knew my son was playing in a hockey tournament in Omaha, and I hurried up and ran and got a job as a referee because I was a really good referee. I was a really, really good. I was probably a better referee than I was a coach. Oh, I was both, but whatever. That's my ego. But I was a really good referee, and I can get a job anywhere reffing any tournament I ever wanted because people really, coaches like me, facilities like me. So anyway, I knew I hurried up and called, got a job at this as a referee for a hockey tournament, and did it just to see my kid, and she was there, and I broke the no contact, and we had some words, and you know, that was it, and I wound up getting arrested again. So anyway, I get out of the Polk County Jail, embarrassed, defeated. I by this time, just so you guys know, I found out that I was Jewish, like DNA wise, I found out I was Jewish, and I found some family history where I was Jewish, and was loved it. Was like, this is amazing. With all the civil rights work I've been doing, this. What, just a gift from God, just a gift from Hashem, as we say. So I was like, you know what, I'm going to try and start following this path, but I was still just trying to get sober, but it wasn't happening. And this is my story, guys, and people can say whatever they want. I was driving up the University Avenue. I just started dating a girl. I found this one Jewish, during my divorce, I find like the one Jewish girl in all of Des Moines, Iowa. I mean, I'm sure there's many, but I found like the one, you know, whatever.
Where at Maccabees? Yeah.
So, but I hadn't thought about truly like transferring over Judaism or anything yet. I just would, it was in a real bad funk, guys. Two of my, just, man, I want people, man, two of my cousins, who one of them was my best man at my wedding, they killed themselves right around this time. My son dies in a car accident. My mom dies of a fentanyl overdose in a crack house in Philly. Like, it was like the worst 5-year run of my life. And so I was leaving this girl's house, driving back over to my friend's house that I was staying at, who was an active alcoholic, not telling his story, just the situation. And I'm driving back to his house where I was kind of staying and living throughout the divorce and just hating life, man. And just, again, as embarrassed about the county jail situation. And so I pulled over at 62nd and University, and I pulled into a church parking lot right there and just started screaming up to God, man. I was like, please, God, fucking kill me. Like, I'm not going to commit suicide because I know that suicide doesn't take the pain away. It just transfers it over to your kids. Now they got to carry that shit. So I was at that point, but I was so, I was almost, I could feel the pain that my cousins felt to kill themselves. I remember thinking, like, I get it. So I pulled over side of the road and was just screaming up to God, like, yo, do it, man. Let a Mack truck hit me. Let this telephone pole fall on me. Let something just kill me so I'm not embarrassing myself or my children anymore. And as I'm screaming up to God and crying in my car, the girl calls me that I was dating. And I pick up the phone, and she's screaming, crying on the phone. And I'm like, what? Why are you, you know, what? And she goes, please get back to my house. My sister just killed herself. And this is my moment, the moment that happened to me, man. It was a blinding light moment in my life. Like, right then and there, the whole world stopped. I mean, even to me, when I remember this moment, because I think about this moment all the time, it felt like even the cars that were driving on University just kind of stopped. And I just was looking for a split second, and this voice came to me and said, get to California, I got work for you. And there was a man that I had met years ago in the rooms of recovery, who had talked to me throughout the years. And the first time I ever met, here's what's funny about this man. First time I ever met the man in 2011, I was at a gathering spot of recovering people. And while I was there, he came over to me because he was a mutual friend of a friend. We were in LA. I was working on a TV show doing interventions on neo-Nazis at the time for AMC, which never went to air, but we filmed a pilot and everything. And I was here doing that at the time. This man comes over to me, and out of the blue, just goes, huh, a fellow Hebe at a meeting. And I was like, I'm not meaning Hebrew, you know? He's like, fellow Hebe at a meeting. I said, I'm not Jewish. I'm a former neo-Nazi, does intervention. I had no idea I was Jewish at the time. And this was the first man's first words to me. But me and him had kept in touch throughout the years. And
he was like, it's the nose. I can tell. It's the nose.
He just knew something. He always told to this day, he's like, how did you not know you weren't Jewish your whole life? You are such a heap, he always says to me, because he's 100%. He's 100%. And so anyway, throughout the years, I talked to him, and he kept saying, he's like, Frank, you're insane, and I can help you. If you ever really want, I can help you. So I called him right when I heard go to California. I didn't hear. I'll tell you, in my own ego, I thought when it said go to California, it meant go be an actor for whatever reason. But I didn't finish listening to the voice because I think it said go be an activist, but I didn't listen because I didn't think about myself. but I called that man and said, "Hey, I'm everything's done here. I need to come out there, and you're going to ask you to spot or be my rabbi, or my recovering rabbi." I said, "I'm gonna come out there, and I need you." And he was like, "Come out." And to this day, man, I still talk to that man every day, every morning. He is, as he says, man, he grabbed my hand and walked me a dozen steps closer to God, and my job is to reach my hand back and walk other men 12 steps or 12 dozen steps back to God. So for how the change was, guys, is that I for the best of my ability, again, I'm not 100%. I'm 100% sober. I'm 100% doing this deal, but is I just try to put others first. And every day I try to wake up and be as spiritual as a person I can be, like be a little bit better than yesterday, try to look at things from other people's point of view, stay out of the thought of self all the time. Because when I really worked with this man and really did some real work on myself, was that I have to stop thinking about myself. And when I think about myself, things go awry. And if I think about others, things will come together. And I'll tell you right now, guys, I lived probably one of the greatest lives I've ever lived. Seriously, I lived probably one of the greatest lives I've ever lived. And it's just by putting people and putting God first, man. I wake up, I pray every morning. I get to go walk on a beach here in LBC. I get to walk on a beach every morning and pray to my God. And you know, I'm now a practicing Jew. I eat kosher. I celebrate Shabbat in my life. I mean, I do the things, and the peace and joy that I have with that is amazing.
Yeah, that's, I mean, it's evolution. It's like we talked from the beginning. I mean, I'm big on it. I mean, I've gone through a lot of my own changes in the last few years, and it's kind of a deal where it's evolve or die, really, you know? And, you know, we were kind of talking about when we had Jordan Bohannon on, I was kind of talking about life, you know, your life kind of being in three acts. And Jordan, he's like in the second act. And I was saying, like, I can't wait for that third act, because right now in his second, you know, he's like 28, you know, where you feel like you lived a bunch of life at 28, you know, and someone like him has lived way more of it than a lot of people at his age. But there's still a lot of, you know, real life stuff that's in store for you between the ages of like 28 and 40 something.
Yeah.
And I think that you and I think what we went through in the last few years was the closing out of our second act. And you know, now it's the third act, and maybe if we're lucky, we live long enough to get a fourth. But like, I feel like in general, you kind of have three acts, and then basically, if you make it beyond life expectancy, it's a fourth one, or maybe you just start over. I don't know. You look at who's the old TV producer, the guy that did
Norman Lear.
Norman Lear, yeah. Like, he's what, almost 100 now, or he is 100. Like, he's talked about it all the time. Like, I'm not the same person at 90 that I was at 75. It's like, what the fuck?
Right.
Like, I always thought, you know, I'd hit 40 and nothing would change about me after that. Like, once I'm 40, that's me, man.
So Frank, where can people find you? You mentioned a podcast that you're on. We're gonna get you wrapped up here.
Yeah. I got the Frank Mink Show. You can find it on any podcast carrier. You know, I have a book that came out in 2011, which is still around and kicking and doing really well. Again, it's crazy that every once in a while it goes through these spurts. Like right now, it's doing really well again, even though it's, you know, 12 years old. Autobiography, Recovering Skinhead. But you can follow me on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it now. You can follow me on any social media. If anyone ever wants to talk about they're having some issues, man, I'm always open to get people you know, they write me and say, hey, and then usually if I vet them out and I see they're safe, and not some, you know, neo-Nazi trying to mess around or whatever, whoever, what it might be, but I give out my number, man, and I'm always
goddamn race traitor.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, you can follow me on any of those social medias. You know, I'm on TikTok. I make a bunch of social justice videos on TikTok if anyone wants to get on there. Just talking about, you know, real police reform. Again, not hating on the police, but some of the real changes I see that we need to make. And so, yeah, follow me on any of the social media stuff, my podcast. And I have a couple other big projects coming out pretty soon that hopefully people will be, once this writer strike is over, which is kind of killing me right now. So
I'll bet. Yeah.
Well,
I just followed you on TikTok and your podcast. So, and on social media. So I really appreciate it. Bill, do you have anything to add?
I obviously appreciate you coming on. It was great to talk to you. It's been a long time, so it was good to catch up. I mean, I obviously been following for a while, but you know, Frank came along at a very pivotal time for me. You know, we're going back to 2013 ish, you know, where I was going through a lot of major shit, and Frank was there, and you know, we spent a lot of time together. I brought him a lot of shit, and I was able to be open about things I was very ashamed to be open about to other people. So it was really nice. I'm glad everything's going well now. You know, I wish I had known a little more, 4 years ago. I wish I would have known what was going on so I could have reached out and hope, you know, maybe return the favor a little bit or something. But I love you, man. And I'm so happy to see everything's going well, and I'll always be here. You know, if you ever need an ear, which would probably seem weird because I was such a fucking baby at the time, but
you're all good, man. Yeah, but... I me too'd you, man. That's all. When you would talk to me, I just meet yeah, me too,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. And it was a lot of it, man. But again, yeah, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope people got something out of it. Again, you know, we're just trying to have a good time talking about hard things, and everybody, you know, we just want to encourage men, especially to be honest and open. And, you know, one thing you can do, I think, is instead of when you're leaving work, nobody has to do this, but like when you're leaving work to go to therapy, And most people will be like, hey, I got a doctor's appointment or whatever. Tell people you're going to therapy. Just be open about it. Just be like, yeah, I'm going to go see my therapist at 2:00. I think just doing that would bring so much more awareness and so much more hope to people. And people would be so much more comfortable if you just said that that's what you're doing. It might make somebody else feel better about it.
It's not weak, man. It's not weak. Actually, strong. Yeah. You know, so it's okay to talk about these things.
100%. Well,
and you might hear somebody say, me too.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
That simple.
I mean, I've credited Bill in this podcast to me recognizing that it's time for me to go get help and to talk it out. Not that I thought that I didn't, that I thought it was silly that anybody else did. But before doing this podcast, I probably didn't recognize that there were things that were bothering me that I could do better at. So, Frank, I feel like we've only just kind of scratched the surface with you. So I would love to be able to have you on again if you'd be open to that.
Absolutely.
Because I think that this has probably been one of our best episodes that we've had in a Frank discussion. And I just feel like we're scratching the surface here with you. So
yeah, man, have me back on.
Awesome.
All right. Hey, brother, thanks again.
Thanks everybody for listening. Check out everybody else's content here on the Three Beards Media Network. And with that, I'm Chris Shipley. This has been Bill Blank. We appreciate you guys listening.
At Revel.